Welcome to the American Cafe. I'm your host, Ira Melman. The search for a new kind of antibiotic might provide an answer to the growing number of resistant bacteria.
These peptides act more by a physical action, by actually punching a hole in the bacterial membrane. So it's a physical disruption as opposed to a poisoning of the bacterial cell.
Jessica Berman is in the cafe with the story. Roseanne Skirbel is here as well with word of a connection between human speech and how birds communicate with each other.
We found convergent changes in genes regulated in speech areas of humans and these song areas of birds. And it's not just one gene, it's not two or five, but over 50 genes.
And we'll check in with Tom Bonsi with a story of how certain plants are grown and the way they might be helping to change the behavior of some prison inmates.
It helps with the level of violence in prison because these inmates all of a sudden they have something else to do and they see the value in it and they see the value of giving back.
All of that and more on this week's American Cafe. In the 1920s, the discovery of penicillin revolutionized the treatment of lethal infections. Today, the challenge is how to battle bacteria that have become resistant to the drugs we use to fight them. Now, some University of Pittsburgh researchers have designed a synthetic compound that might hold promise in the fight against so-called superbugs. VOA's Jessica Berman is here with more.
The novel man-made antibiotic works in a completely different way than traditional antibiotics. According to University of Pittsburgh Center for Vaccine Research co-director Ron Montalero.
Antibiotics are drugs that typically poison the bacterial cell by blocking some metabolic process. These peptides act more by a physical action, by actually punching a hole in the bacterial membrane. So it's a physical disruption as opposed to a poisoning of the bacterial cell.
And finding new ways to kill drug-resistant bacteria that cause diseases like tuberculosis and pneumonia is becoming a medical necessity. A report commissioned by the British government reported this month that drug-resistant bacteria could cause 10 million deaths a year and cost world governments billions of dollars. The report blamed the rise of superbugs mainly on the overuse of antibiotics. Antibiotic use rose 40% between 2000 and 2010, according to the British report. The World Health Organization reports there were some 450,000 cases of multidrug-resistant TB alone in 2012. The peptide designed by Montalero's team was modeled after the tail end of an HIV protein, which punches a hole in human immune cells to infect them. The new synthetic peptides destroy bacteria in much the same way. While two traditional antibiotics slowed or stopped about 50% of the bacteria tested, the man-made drug stopped about 90%. Some of the testing was done on a blood-borne infection in mice, according to Montalero.
This would be an infection we give the mice that is 100% fatal within 24 hours, and by giving this particular dose, we were able to rescue 100% of the mice. And not only keep them from dying, but show that we had completely removed any detectable bacteria in the mice.
The findings were published in the journal Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy. The work was funded by the U.S. National Institutes of Health. Montalero hopes to move to human clinical trials in the next couple years after finding a pharmaceutical company that might be interested in the synthetic peptide antibiotic. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
With more than 2 million people behind bars, the United States has the largest incarcerated population in the world. But in a growing number of American prisons, inmates are doing more than just time. They're rearing endangered plants, animals, butterflies for release in the wild. This started just over a decade ago when a state university teamed up with a minimum security prison near Olympia, Washington. Now the concept has spread from coast to coast and is even attracting interest from overseas. Tom Bonsi went to a prison to bring us this story.
past two metal detectors and multiple guarded double gates topped with razor wire sits Washington State's Stafford Creek Prison greenhouse complex. There, a small crew wearing standard prison-issued khakis is sowing perennials. Months from now, these flowers will be transplanted to remnant prairies around Washington's Puget Sound to provide food for endangered butterflies.
These plants are so fickle.
Toby Erhardt and his fellow inmates have plenty of time to nurture, experiment, and hone their craft on tray after tray of seedlings.
You cannot have a nursery that produces these for money because they would go broke or the cost would be so high that nobody could ever restore anything with them. So that's why this is such a good fit to have prisoners doing this because, well, I mean, they don't have to pay as much. So.
The convicted child rapist says his greenhouse work has made him more observant and conscientious. That's the sort of outcome prison superintendent Pat Glebe likes to see.
It helps with the level of violence in prison because these inmates all of a sudden they have something else to do and they see the value in it and they see the value of giving back.
Glebe says many people have a preconceived notion of what prison looks like. Then they tour his facility and can't help saying, wow. Stafford Creek's Prison Conservation Nursery has produced more than 1 million rare and endangered prairie plants since it opened 5 years ago. Inmates elsewhere are turning over a new leaf, too. At a state prison in Ohio, inmates are rearing endangered eastern hellbender salamanders for release in the wild. In Maryland, inmates do some of the heavy lifting to prepare bags of oyster shells used in restoration of the Chesapeake Bay. In Oregon, a voter-approved ballot measure has long required all inmates to work full-time or attend classes that tests prison managers to find meaningful work activity for everyone and further explains why Oregon's prison system was fertile ground to host conservation nurseries. A combination of federal, state, and private foundation grants cover most program costs. Tom Kay directs the Institute for Applied Ecology. That's one of the partners bringing money to the table in the Oregon Sustainability in Prisons project. He says, as you might expect, working in prisons presents some challenges.
Just going to visit and volunteer at a prison is no simple task. You have to watch your dress code. You have to watch how you behave in prisons.
But Kay says sticking with it is paying off handsomely on all sides.
Oh, the advantages far outweigh any of these disadvantages. Because we're able to get so much more done for ourselves in the mission that we are trying to accomplish.
And we have to settle it out to get the air out of it.
Participating inmates are paid a nominal rate for their labor, less than a dollar an hour in the Pacific Northwest. The gardening tasks sometimes appear tedious and repetitive.
A couple good scoops.
But that didn't stop inmate Joseph Jonge from applying for a transfer to the 2,000-bed Stafford Creek Prison specifically so he could compete for a job in the conservation nursery.
It's hard to get into the program, but when you get into the program, what they teach you is something that you probably won't get somewhere else, you know, because most of the seeds they're having us grow are endangered plants that you won't find anywhere else in the U.S. except here.
The Kenyan native could be deported when he finishes his 16-year sentence for murder. Jonge hopes his newfound skills give him a leg up for a conservation job wherever he ends up.
I've made it that this is what I'm going to do when I get out of here.
Washington's original environmental science program has branched out in many directions. At this prison, inmates also train shelter dogs to make them more adoptable. Other inmates are trying their hand at fish farming. They're growing a warm water food fish called tilapia in solar heated tanks. Yet other inmates refurbish bicycles and wheelchairs for the needy on the outside. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi near Aberdeen, Washington.
$65 million years ago, an asteroid hit the planet, killing the dinosaurs and many other life forms. Birds were among the survivors, and after that mass extinction, as life began to flower again, a burst of evolution gave rise to more than 10,000 bird species we know today. As VOA's Roseanne Scurble reports, researchers worldwide have joined to create the most reliable avian tree of life to date.
Prior to this project, scientists had sequenced the genome for just three birds, the chicken, the turkey, and the zebra finch.
The new tree includes the genome of 45 more, from hummingbirds to ostriches. Older studies randomly sampled single genes. The whole sequences give scientists like Duke University neurobiologist Eric Jarvis a complete set of new patterns to examine.
We want to find genes that are associated with particular complex traits like vocal learning or the ability to fly and so forth. And just looking at one gene at a time out of 10 or 20,000 genes is a lot of effort.
So chances of finding genes of interest are much better with the entire genome scan. Scientists used those genomes to build the bird tree, but it wasn't easy. The analysis suggested that each gene or genomic region had its own evolutionary history, says Tandy Warnow, a professor of computer science at the University of Illinois.
When we analyzed these, you know, roughly 50 total genomes and roughly 14,000 regions of the genomes, we discovered that every single genomic region had a different estimated tree. So this means that evolution is changing as you go across the genome. And to have this much variation meant we had to do something substantially more innovative.
Warnow and her colleagues developed a technique that could construct more accurate evolutionary histories for the genes, and therefore a better species tree. Studies based on the tree are reported in 28 articles released in the journal Science and other publications. The new research confirms that birds had teeth, showing it imprinted in their genome. Another article, co-authored by Eric Jarvis, extends previous work on human speech and birdsong.
But we didn't know if that behavior and anatomical similarity was associated with genetic similarity. And our most important finding is that we found convergent changes in genes regulated in speech areas of humans and the song areas of birds. And it's not just one gene, it's not two or five, but over 50 genes.
So birds, rather than monkeys or gorillas that do not have those genes, are models for studying speech in humans. Jarvis expects that the avian tree will help scientists answer fundamental questions for years to come. The massive project engaged 200 researchers worldwide. The data sets will be made public for future work. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush has taken a major step toward running for president in 2016. Bush posted messages on his Facebook page and Twitter account that he plans to actively explore a bid for the Republican Party's presidential nomination, with a final decision expected next year. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone comes to visit us in the cafe with more.
In his announcement, Jeb Bush said he had discussed a possible White House bid with his family last month over the Thanksgiving holiday and decided to actively explore a presidential bid in the months ahead. Bush would be considered one of the favorites for the Republican Party nomination should he decide to run in what is expected to be a very crowded field of Republican presidential contenders for 2016. Bush discussed the possibility of a presidential campaign in a recent interview with Miami television station WPLG.
I am who I've been. I believe in reform when things are broken, and I believe in limited government, and I believe in liberty being the driver of a successful country. And as part of that, fixing a broken immigration system is critical.
Bush's stance on immigration reform has drawn fire from conservatives within the Republican Party, some of whom are likely to challenge him in the Republican presidential primaries if he decides to run. Bush said he believes voters are looking for a candidate who embodies big ideas.
You can do big things if you set the stage in a campaign and then move forward, so that if you run with big ideas, and then you're true to those ideas and get a chance to serve and implement them and do it with passion and conviction, you can move the needle. And that's what we need right now in America.
In the latest McClatchy-Maris poll on potential Republican presidential contenders, Bush came in second with 14% support, behind the 2012 Republican nominee Mitt Romney, who had 19%. Bush's announcement is likely to set off a chain reaction among other Republicans considering a presidential bid in 2016 and could cause some of them to speed up their timetable for deciding on a presidential run. John Fortier is a political analyst with the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington.
The Republicans will have a large field of people and various wings of the party represented, and it's a little unclear in that multi-candidate race how someone will emerge or who will emerge.
Bush has strong name recognition nationally and is a proven fundraiser, but he's not run a campaign since 2002 and would be running in a Republican party that has grown more conservative. Jeb Bush won two elections as governor in Florida with help from Hispanic voters, and Republicans may be looking for a candidate who can appeal more broadly to a 2016 electorate that will include growing numbers of Hispanic and Asian American voters. President Obama relied on Hispanic support in his two election victories in 2008 and 2012. Republican strategist Whit Ayers says Bush's ability to draw Hispanic votes could be an asset in the 2016 election.
We got a third of the Hispanic vote. We've got to do better with Hispanics, with Asians. You've seen that coming. It's not arguable. And it's simply the challenge that we have to meet successfully if we will ever elect another president.
In addition to Bush, the Republican presidential field could include New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, Texas Governor Rick Perry, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, and Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, among others. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
The 22nd African Diaspora International Film Festival has taken place in New York with 89 films from the African continent as well as Europe, Asia, and the Americas. VOA's Carolyn Weaver has a report.
An excerpt from The Pirogue, one of dozens of Africa-inspired films screening at the African Diaspora International Film Festival. For 2 weeks each year, it offers New Yorkers the chance to see features and documentaries from all over the world, with just one thing in common. They are all stories about people of color. Showing this year, for example, is a documentary exploring the African roots of Argentine tango music, and a feature narrative about a France-raised woman's search for her father on the Caribbean island of Guadeloupe. One of several films set in Guadeloupe. And a musical documentary about Nigerian prostitutes in Europe.
If they arrest you, you will not say any word to the police. You will not tell the people that brought you to Europe. You will not tell them where you live. You don't give them any information.
Colleen Burchett is among the Riverside Church African Fellowship members who volunteer for the festival.
They represent African filmmakers, and African filmmakers have such a difficult time getting what we call their counter-narratives, their perspectives, into the mainstream media so that their voices are heard.
Filmmaking by Black Africans was discouraged, even illegal in some countries, before independence. Temple University professor Molefi Keti-Asante.
During the colonial period, film was used mainly in a political sense and also to point out the atrocities of apartheid. So in South Africa, the films that I grew up on were films that just made you want to do something about the condition in the country.
This year, however, the festival was celebrating 20 years of democracy in South Africa. Mabato Ramagoshi, chair of the National Film and Video Foundation, introduced several young filmmakers.
Because we know that in investing in the young people, we are now investing in our future. So please look at them and support them going forward. Thank you very much.
Zuko Nadada directed the centerpiece film for the evening, Between Friends, South Africa's first ever romantic comedy.
How dare you make a mockery of me?
I think it was about time where people wanted to watch a film that they would feel good afterwards. And there was no better way than telling this reunion story where you've got a bunch of young people in a beautiful lodge just having a holiday.
Other themes at this year's festival include films about racial issues in France and blacks in Latin America and the Caribbean. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
Since the 1960s, Trudy Lynn has been singing the blues, sometimes with well-known performers like Ike and Tina Turner. A couple of months ago, she hit the top of the Billboard Blues chart with the CD Royal Oaks Blues Cafe, which she recorded with harmonica player Steve Kreis in her hometown of Houston, Texas. They also went on the road, performing around the country and at a blues festival in Switzerland last month. VOA's Greg Flakes recently spoke to them about their musical collaboration and filed this report from Houston.
The chart-topping blues CD, Royal Oaks Blues Cafe, represents a musical collaboration between two good friends. Known around Houston as the First Lady of the Blues, Trudy Lynn enjoys a lot of support in the town where she was born more than 60 years ago. Steve Kreis came to Houston 25 years ago from Long Island, New York, and taught himself to play the harmonica while learning more about music from Lynn and other veteran blues artists. He now sometimes teaches other people how to play. His own recordings have made the charts, but he takes special pleasure in the collaboration with his dear friend of many years.
That's true love.
Trudy's great, and I've always known she was great, and just honored to be in her presence and honored to be on the stage with her.
Lynn says she came to Kreis about a year ago with a concept in mind, to revisit some of the songs recorded by women blues singers more than 80 years ago.
I wanted to do these female blues singer songs from the 30s and the 20s, you know, and so we got together and started collaborating on it and came up with the CD.
Both of them say they enjoy being swept up by the emotional power of the blues, and Steve says it often binds him to his instrument.
When I'm playing well, I feel like it's part of me.
You have to feel it. It's a feel. You feel it, don't you?
Yeah, Steve? Absolutely.
Because you have to feel it in order to exceed and make it come out and make other people feel it. You got to feel it.
From street to street, easy as can be.
Lynn chose the songs from old recordings and also wrote two new songs to complete the package, improvising everything with Kreis and the other musicians in Houston's Red Shack studio.
Trudy brought him in and kind of, you know, We just played the blues.
Just give me this and I'm going to jump right on off.
We probably recorded 12 songs.
In one day. If I don't
love you, baby. They're now developing material for a new recording with plans to go into the studio in February and release a CD a few months later. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
That's all the time we have for this week's program. Our thanks to executive producer Bob Doty. If you'd like to hear more about these stories, check out our website at voanews.com. Also our Facebook page at VOA American Cafe. We'd also like to hear from you. Send us an email from wherever you are to our studios here in Washington, D.C. Email us at americancafe@voanews.com. For all the folks here at VOA, I'm Ira Melman. We'll see you next time on American Cafe.